Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are here for our first session today, our first case, and it is 2020-143, State of Ohio versus Abdul S. Azeem. Before we begin, you'll notice that Justice Donnelly is not sitting with us on this case, and we have in his place Judge Pietrzakowski. I'm sorry, Judge. And he is from Lucas County, and we welcome you, Judge. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you.
For the appellant, we have Ms. Mullen.
Thank you. Chief Justice O'Connor, justices, may it please the court, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Over a decade ago, this court said that in order for a guilty plea to be a negotiated plea within the meaning of State versus Carpenter, the record must show the existence of the elements of a contract.
Before we get there, I do want to ask, what's the state's position on the standard of review? It seems like your opposition colleague mixed question law and fact, and there's case law, could say de novo, could say abuse of discretion. What's the state's position?
I think the motions to dismiss are generally reviewed with discretion to the trial court's findings, as long as they're supported by competent, credible evidence, and then de novo on the questions of law.
Thank you.
This case is here today because the appellate court has dispensed with Dye's requirement that the elements of a contract appear on the record. Instead, in Cuyahoga County, the lack of evidence is now evidence itself. A recent search on Lexis shows that Carpenter has been cited in Ohio 53 times, multiple times by this court. Critical to this court's analysis in each case before it was whether the defendant entered a negotiated guilty plea. And to find this and to look for the terms of a contract, one generally looks at the agreement itself. But when this court does that in this case, it is clear that there was no agreement between Azeem and the state. The state asks this court to reverse the dismissal of Azeem's aggravated murder indictment. Carpenter does not apply in the absence of an agreement by the parties, which does not exist here. This court accepted two propositions of law for review, both of which challenged the applicability of Carpenter to Azeem's case. And if I may, I'd like to begin with the second proposition. Our second proposition of law argued that Carpenter does not apply to unnegotiated no contest pleas.
Counselor, can I stop you right there? First of all, so for the first proposition of law, do you concede that that's forfeited?
No, I don't concede that that's forfeited, Your Honor. I don't believe that it's forfeited because while the state argued primarily that Carpenter was distinguishable and not that Carpenter did not apply retroactively, I think that the underlying issue about whether Carpenter can apply at all is still applicable in the second proposition of law. So even if this court were to not address the state's first proposition of law, the fact that the reservation of rights requirement did not exist until 6 years after Azeem's plea is an important factor for consideration when we're looking at finality in the second proposition of law.
But although Carpenter didn't exist at the time of the plea, it existed at the time the motion to dismiss was filed, and yet you never raised it. You never raised that argument at the time the motion to dismiss was filed.
We argued that Carpenter was inapplicable because of the lack of negotiation, but you're correct, Justice Stewart, that we did not raise, at the trial court, we did not raise that Carpenter did not apply retroactively. So if this court were to find that the first proposition is waived or forfeited, the fact that the state did not have to reserve its rights though, which is an indisputable fact, is still a consideration for whether or not Azeen's plea would satisfy the requirements of Carpenter.
Counsel, let's follow up on that a little bit. The quote at the transcript from the hearing was, quote, from the state, I think that's the only question the court has to ask. If this court finds that there was a negotiated plea, although I don't know how it could, then Carpenter applies. Isn't that, are you inviting error here?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor. And I do recognize that we didn't make a nice, clear argument at the trial court about retroactivity. I certainly recognize that. But the when we're looking at finality for, in the Carpenter context, we look at the defendant's expectation. And a lot of what we've looked at in Harrison and Zima and Carpenter and Dye are what the parties knew at the time. So the, let's say the status of the victim, was the victim close to death? Those kind of factors that you would look for the elements to support reasonable expectation of finality. And along with that, the court has consistently looked at, well, did the state reserve its rights? And I would agree here that we did not reserve our rights in 1987, but we didn't reserve our rights because that wasn't a requirement in 1987.
Well, Kelso, then if we look at, go to your second proposition of law as stated, it says State versus Carpenter does not apply to unnegotiated no contest pleas. We can technically answer that question in the affirmative, but that's not really what you're asking us here. You're asking us here today to determine whether the circumstances, the facts of this case, constitute a negotiated plea or not, or constitute or is unnegotiated. So you're really asking us to make a factual finding based on the facts of this case, but your proposition of law doesn't really address that, because we can answer that in your favor, that State versus Carpenter does not apply to unnegotiated no contest pleas, but then say that, but this isn't an unnegotiated plea, or say we can't determine whether this is or not. So your analysis really isn't, or either your proposition of law isn't helpful to your case, or your analysis does not address your proposition of law.
Maybe I worded my proposition of law too broadly, but I believe that the proposition of law asked this court to say that Carpenter does not apply to an unnegotiated plea. And while I wrote that as an unnegotiated no contest plea, I would believe it would have the same applicability to an unnegotiated guilty plea if a defendant were to walk in and enter a guilty plea to the entire indictment without any form of agreement by the parties.
But didn't the trial court and the appellate court cite facts that led them to determine that this was a negotiated? Well, and I guess at least in my mind, it was, I thought you were asking one to say that these circumstances were not negotiated. This is an unnegotiated plea. And then I couldn't quite determine whether you were asking to also not put a no contest plea in the same category as a guilty plea after a plea bargain. Were you trying to make that distinction also?
No, I think that is something that that I think is part of actually what I filed for reconsideration for in the 8th District. No contest pleas certainly can be negotiated. I've personally done it myself. Guilty pleas themselves can certainly be negotiated. I've done that myself. But in a circumstance like the one that we have here, where there is the elements of a contract do not exist in the plea transcript from 1987, when we have that fails to satisfy what this court was concerned with in Carpenter and Zima and Harrison and Dye, because Carpenter is focused, and this court said this in State versus Dye, Carpenter is focused on making sure the prosecutor follows up with a promise that's made. That's Santabello versus New York. So that's what Carpenter cited to, and that's what State versus Thomas that Carpenter relied on cited to. There is nothing in the transcript or anything presented by the defendant in support of his motion to dismiss that shows that there was an agreement on behalf of the prosecutor in this case.
And yet both the trial court and the appellate court found that there was. So you really want us to correct the factual determination of the trial court and the appellate court?
I think in part, we want you to correct the factual findings. I would agree with that. But I think it's broader than that because the problem that we have here and the reason this it doesn't fall into an error correction type case is because if you look at the Eighth District's decision, and I think specifically I'm looking at paragraph 27, I believe, but if you look at the Eighth District's decision where they are considering what in the record they believe supports the trial court's findings, that is based on supposition and conjecture of what, how they interpret what happened there. I cannot disagree with the Eighth District or the trial court, and I don't disagree, that clearly there was an off-the-record discussion. But what I do disagree with is that there is any evidence that the state entered into an agreement. And when I say the state, I mean the prosecutor, I should clarify that, that there is any evidence that the prosecutor entered into an agreement for or with Azeem. A defendant can enter a no contest plea to the indictment and the state cannot do anything to prevent that whatsoever.
Why does someone enter a no contest plea? I mean, it seems like it's almost an indicia of some kind of negotiated agreement.
Generally a no contest plea, I mean, in my historic understanding, generally no contest plea is entered so that you can preserve an issue that you would like to raise on appeal, most often a motion to suppress. But in this case, and this goes back to the problem of
I'm sorry to interrupt that, but let me insert this. Doesn't it also mean that the person is not gets by with not admitting they admit their guilt in the colloquy, but it's different from just outright pleading guilty. No contest sort of leaves a chance for maybe the judge to find something good in their favor, correct?
Correct. The court could theoretically, once the prosecutor recites the facts as they would expect them to be, the court could theoretically find that the facts do not support the charges when a defendant enters a no contest plea. That, of course, that's not what happened here. What happened here was that the trial court and the parties came out on the record and the court started to go through a criminal rule 11 colloquy and state what the potential penalties were for the offenses that were charged at the time. And the trial court did, I would agree, the trial court did make a statement that said, you know, I let your defense attorney know that I plan to give you essentially the minimum sentence once you enter this no contest plea. And ultimately that is the sentence that the trial court imposed. The prosecutor did put a recitation of facts on the record for the no contest plea when it was his
time. Also, did the prosecutor object to the judge giving the minimum sentence or at any time during that exchange?
No, the prosecutor didn't object, Your Honor, but I would argue that that's not.
Let me ask another question. Then the judge says, "I informed your attorney." Okay, I would presume that is not an ex parte communication.
I would presume so too, Your Honor.
Okay, so that would suggest to me that the prosecutor and the defense attorney were in the judge's chambers or sidebar or wherever this took place. And there was obviously the opportunity to participate in what the judge was saying based on information that both attorneys gave him, correct?
Correct, I would assume that's what happened, Your Honor.
What more do you need in order to, for example, this is a no contest. A lot of times the defendant benefits from a no contest because then they don't go to trial and they don't incur what is commonly referred to as a trial tax. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would agree with that, Your Honor.
Okay, so that could very well have been part of the consideration here of course, that's not going to be put on the record. A judge is not going to say, you know, thank you for saving the state, the trial, the cost of the trial and time. But those are all things that are discussed behind behind the scenes, off the record with the court.
I would agree with that, Your Honor, but I think that even though we recognize that those things might be things that happen off the record, what we know we need under State versus Dye is we need the elements of the contract to appear on the record. And that didn't happen here because we're speculating about what happened off the record.
You've been in judges' courtrooms. I mean, it's very common for judges to go back with the prosecutor and the defense counsel. And many judges will say, this is the kind of sentence I would be likely to give on these facts. I mean, that happens all the time, right?
Right, absolutely.
I mean, there's not an agreement there. There's not a contract when that happens, is there?
Correct, absolutely, I mean, Your Honor. I would agree with
that. So, I mean, there's nothing uncommon about a judge having an off-the-record conversation with counsel about the possible sentence the judge would give if someone pled guilty.
No, there's correct, Your Honor. I would agree with that. And I think that's
There's no way we could infer an agreement from that, is there?
No, there's not, Your Honor. I agree with what you said. And I think that's why Dye requires more. I think that's why Dye requires it to, I think that's why Dye requires the elements to be on the record. And that wasn't done here. You know, and the defendant had the opportunity. The defendant filed the motion to dismiss. He could have presented evidence to say that there was this, you know, maybe an affidavit or something to say that there was this backroom deal and that the prosecutor really did agree. There was no evidence of that presented in support of the motion to dismiss.
Was the motion to dismiss filed when the defendant was competent or not competent to assist his counsel in his own defense?
That's a good question, Your Honor. I believe at that point he had already been restored to competency. He was previously found incompetent in a 2011 case, but restored to competency there and convicted. And then I believe he was restored to competency again here at the time, at least for sure at the time of the hearing on the motion to dismiss, I believe that he was. And I would like to reserve any remaining time I have for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Ms. Cunliffe?
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. My name is Erica Cunliffe. I represent Abdulazim. I just want to clarify the standard of review. In motions to dismiss, it's de novo regarding the questions of law, and it's the factual findings are reviewed to determine whether they're clearly erroneous. As far as the retroactivity argument, our position is that Carpenter and Dye did not create a new rule. The case does not involve retroactive applications of new constitutional principles. Teague versus Lane does not apply to this case. What this court did in Carpenter was refer
but none to- None of that matters if there's no agreement, does it? None of that matters if there's no agreement.
I'm happy to focus, Justice DeWine, on the question of whether or not there was an agreement.
I mean, is there any evidence that there was an agreement other than that they talked to the judge beforehand?
I believe that there is evidence in this record to support the trial court's finding that there was an agreement here. And I would direct this court to the transcript, three places in the transcript of the actual change of plea, page 3. The court begins by announcing that this is going to be a no contest plea. There's no initial colloquy at all.
So how does that show there's an agreement? I mean, every no contest plea I ever took as a trial judge, the parties asked me in advance if I would accept a no contest plea. I mean, I can't imagine anyone would plead no contest without talking to the judge first.
That's true. And I guess the question is,
so that doesn't show an agreement.
How much was the prosecutor involved in the negotiations, and was there a meeting of minds
that right. involved and so, both so the judge and the prosecutor? Is there any evidence that there was an agreement? That's what I'm.
Well, I believe that is one piece. I also believe that when the court announces on page 10 that the defendant can expect to receive a sentence of essentially 8 years, 3 years mandatory plus 5 to 25.
How's the judge saying what sentence he or she is going to give show an agreement? Judges all the time tell people ahead of time what sentence they will get if they plead guilty.
Justice DeWine, I agree that there is nothing announced on this record that the prosecutor is saying, we agree to A, B, C, and D, and the defendant will do D, E, F, and G. I agree that that is the case. But I also think there are other factors.
Based on contract principles, is there anything in here that anyone would think would show a contract?
Yes.
Other than the fact that the judge said this is going to be a no contest plea and knew that in advance, that doesn't show a contract. You couldn't, in any other context, no one would even come close to thinking that was a contract.
Your Honor, I would direct your attention to page 9 as well of the transcript, when the court explains the having a weapons under disability, that's count 3. At that point, there is a question. At the time, the law was in 1987 that sentence imposed on an F4, where it's an aggravated felony, is 2 to 5 years. The prosecutor says, well, if you want definite time there, you've got to strike the furthermore clause. And the court says, fine. And so ultimately, the defendant receives a sentence of 18 months, which is not too short.
So we have some pretty good evidence that the court knew in advance, or the parties knew in advance, what the sentence was going to be. But you'd have to concede that happens all the time in courtrooms without there being an agreement to plead guilty.
I don't disagree that it happens all the time. But the only person who can strike the furthermore clause and make the having a weapon under disability flat time is the prosecutor. And that happened in this case. I'm not saying it's a big deal. I'm just saying it's one piece of a lot of pieces that suggests this is a no contest plea. We know we can have no contest pleas that are negotiated with the state. It happens all the time. It's also important to note that the parties in this case, all the players were present for this hearing. This hearing took.
Can I ask you? Can you hear me now? Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can.
As Ms. Mullen brought out, couldn't defense counsel have submitted an affidavit that simply says the results of this case, the sentence, the no contest plea, the predicted time was negotiated with conversations with prosecutor? Could a simple affidavit to state that been submitted in this case?
I drafted the motion to dismiss in this case and reached out to Jeffrey Kelleher, who was fighting cancer at the time, and he agreed to help. We spoke at length about what his common practice was at the time. He did not remember this case explicitly. His reputation in this county was extraordinary. And all he said was, I had to have fought hard on that case, because I was trying the heck out of things at that point in my career. And then he passed away. So the only thing we had in support of this was my affidavit that I had spoken to him. The players aren't here anymore. And so the other thing that this court should look to and consider in this context is, again, all the players were here, the prosecutors here, the victims were there.
Can I interrupt you a minute?
Of course.
Sorry about the background noise. Did this go directly to sentencing after the plea without a pre-sentence investigation?
Yes, Justice Bruner, it did. I mean, everybody was there because they knew there was going to be a sentencing. This case was not set for trial. It was, 8 weeks in after indictment.
Of course, defense counsel would not be smart to ask for a PSI if the judge has already said they're going to give the client the minimum, right? I mean, if no rational defense counsel, if the judge is said in chambers, I'm going to give the minimum sentence, would ask for a PSI. It could only hurt.
I acknowledge that, but I think that also goes to the fact that everybody knew exactly what was going to happen here. And you know, the prosecutor.
But again, this is why I'm having such a hard time. Mm-hmm. We all agree everything the record shows, everyone knew what was going to happen. But what Carpenter says is the record has to show the elements of a contract, and that everyone knew what was going to happen doesn't make it an agreement. Simply, all that shows is that The judge told people what was going to happen.
I think that this court's decision in State versus Zima goes a long way to clarifying exactly what Carpenter means. And Zima talks about how Carpenter recognized an implied contract and that there are implied rights here. This is all going back to Santabello, which talks about, you know, why we want guilty pleas, why they're necessary, why they're important, why they're good things, but that we have to put safeguards in there to protect the reasonable expectations of the defendant. And so in Zima's case, this court reflected that, yes, these agreements can be implied, they need not be explicit, but that in Zima's case, she had no reasonable belief that her plea in that case would be final and would end the case. I think in this case, it's considerably different. And pivoting over to the trial court's observation.
Why is that different in this case that this defendant was, that they thought that this was a final disposition of this case? The victim didn't die for, 15 years later or maybe even longer?
27.
All right, my math, never been good. Okay, 27 years later. So, and he died, from what I understand, is a consequence of being confined in a wheelchair with ulcerations, et cetera. That was not anticipated. There was nothing imminent about this. This was supposed to be a final end to this case for both the state and the defendant. Is that a fair statement?
It's a fair statement, but I think that Zima and Carpenter suggest that the state shouldn't be able to prosecute further based on the circumstances here. I just want to underscore for a minute what the trial court was finding here was not just these little bits and pieces, the reputations of the lawyers involved or the judges involved. It was also based on his understanding from practicing in the Cuyahoga County Court of Common Pleas in the 80s and 90s about how that court operated with backroom deals. I mean, it's been something that the trial court has commented on frequently. It is something that he cares about.
I'm sorry to interrupt your thought there, but just before I forget, can I go back to a question I asked Ms. Mullen about how proposition of law number two is stated? Can we answer that question without determining whether the Court of Appeals and the trial court erred in its factual determination?
I think that you'd have to look at what Judge Donnelly did. And then you'd have to look at what the Court of Appeals did, all three of whom have practiced in the Cuyahoga County Court of Common Pleas Criminal Division, either as judges, prosecutors, or defense lawyers, and say, no, you were clearly erroneous here.
Counselor, that concerns me a little bit because what Carpenter says is the judge has to make that decision based on the record. And I don't think the judge gets to weigh in on his general philosophy about what happens in Cuyahoga County. It has to be facts in the record, isn't that right? I mean, you're asking us to go beyond the record and think what's actually in the record in front of us, aren't you there?
Justice DeWine, I don't think that you can ask the trial courts who are looking at the facts of a case to ignore their own personal experiences, their own reputation, the reputations of the people involved, the judges involved, the practices involved. I do not think that you can do that in this context.
So you think that when we say a case has to be decided and a judge has to look at the facts and the record, they can go beyond that if they have experience with people and surmise what they think might have happened rather than rely on the facts and the record?
What I'm saying is that those observations, those reflections, that those experiences of those jurists do not render their decision making clearly erroneous.
Shouldn't the result in Vinton County be the same result in Cuyahoga County and vice versa?
Yeah.
But that doesn't sound like what you're saying.
No, what I'm saying is that that clearly this is not best practices, all right? But what we're doing now is looking at what happened 30 years ago through a professionalism lens that we have now. And what happened here appropriate, right, or whatever? No, the record, if you look at the transcript, it's not even, it's kind of a mess. People go on the record, off the record. We're not even clear if the lawyers, you know the law. There's some mix up here about what's mandatory time, what isn't, what's probationable, what isn't. It's hardly best practices, but that's not what we're looking at. We're not trying to have best practices. We're looking at whether the trial court's decision to dismiss this prosecution, this 30-year-old prosecution, was clearly erroneous. And I, you know, I've handled three out of the four cases that have involved this issue out of this county, and they just don't happen all that often. This is a white elephant. It's not going to happen again. But I do think that this court can ignore the understandings of the jurists who looked at what happened here and going, oh God, this was a problem back then.
Let me stop you to ask you to, could there have been an affidavit from the prosecutor that said, could the state have submitted an affidavit from the prosecutor that said there was no negotiations or no plea, I wasn't involved in anything?
Sure, if he remembered. As far as I know, he's not available.
And can you talk?
None of the parties were available or remembered.
And can you speak to the retroactive application of Carpenter?
I can. I think that what Carpenter was based upon, if you look at that decision, it's clear that they're looking at Santabello, which was decided in 1971, which talks about we need guilty pleas. Our system can't operate without them. They're good things. They're necessary. And we need to provide safeguards in addition to just looking at contract principles. We need to have due process safeguards in order to ensure the reasonable understandings of the defendant who's entering the plea. And based on that, Carpenter said, you need to reserve if you want to prosecute further in the event of changes. Zima looked again at Carpenter and said, Carpenter was an analysis, a mixture of contract principles and due process applied to the facts of a specific case. I'd point out that in Carpenter, when this court resolved that the state couldn't prosecute him for murder without reserving, the court reversed and remanded and ordered the case be dismissed. And if the prosecutor's argument is that the state didn't have notice that they needed to reverse, then this court shouldn't have ordered Carpenter's case to be dismissed. It's just the fact of the matter is there was no new ground broken in Carpenter. It was simply, you know, the application of traditional contract principles and due process to these kinds of plea arrangements. With that, Your Honors, I'd ask that you affirm the decision of the Court of Common Pleas and the Court of Appeals.
Thank you. Ms. Mullen, you've used your time. You may take a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. The only way that Azeen would prevail on this type of a record is if this court expanded Carpenter to encompass any type of plea, whether there was an agreement or not. And in State versus Dye, this court rejected that and said, we caution that we are not holding that every plea is a negotiated plea within the meaning of Carpenter. And it's for the reasons enunciated in Justice Lundberg Stratton's dissent in Dye that I would direct this court to not make any form of an expansion and limit Carpenter to what it was meant to be. Carpenter, turning just very briefly to retroactivity, Carpenter clearly broke new ground. The United States Supreme Court case, and I hope I pronounce this right, is Chaidez, Chaidez, is I think directly on point here. The district court there had said that there was no new rule. And the United States Supreme Court ultimately held otherwise, because created an additional burden on the state, just like Carpenter did in this case. I'd like to thank the court for their time, and I would ask that the court reverse the decision to dismiss Azeen's appeal. Carpenter is clearly inapplicable here. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.